Hi, everybody. My name is Peggy Curran, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
I just asked Marvin where my crown was. I thought I was going to be canonized there for a minute. And you know, that is, it's wonderful to be able to experience having friends say nice things about you. I don't know about anyone else, but when I was in my active addiction, very few people said nice things about me, including myself. I was introduced to, I was looking at the title of this conference, The Sunlight of the Spirit, and it kind of tells the story about, in my mind, how I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, because prior to my walking into my first AA meeting, my spirit, I believe, was dead, and at least wilted greatly. And when I walked into that very first AA meeting, which was January the 10th, 1979, I do believe that that was the first ray of sunshine that shined on my spirit, because I did not know that I was an alcoholic, and I did not know what was wrong with me. What I knew was that I could not stop drinking, that my life was a mess, that I hated myself and everyone around me, that I was a failure miserably as a mother and as a wife and as a human being, or at least that's how I felt. I had absolutely no redeemable qualities that I could see about myself when I walked into that first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And what I experienced at that first meeting was a miracle and is a miracle to this day. There's a woman that I really enjoy reading her books and listening to her tapes. Her name is Marianne Williamson. And Marianne Williamson's definition of a miracle is a shift in perception. And that's about the closest thing I can come to describe what happened to me when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. It was very slow and very subtle, and there were wonderful, wonderful people that were put in my life from the very first meeting that were able to open the doors for me and allow me to be able to see that I was not the scum of the earth, that I did have some redeemable qualities. I was loaded with fear. I was just one quivering mass of fear. And I just didn't know what to do. Prior to my walking into that first AA meeting, I'll just give you a little bit of background about how I got to that point. I was raised in an Irish Catholic family. CIA, Catholic, what is it, Catholic Irish alcoholic, and in West Philadelphia. And in West Philadelphia, we had tap rooms. I don't know if they have them here in New York. But they're just your local corner bar. They call them tap rooms. And my father was an alcoholic. Unfortunately, he was never given the gift of recovery, and he died at age 59 from this disease. However, when I was a little girl, my father liked to take me to the corner bar with him, to the tap room. And guess what? I loved it. And I would sit on the bar stool when I was 4 or 5 years old, 6 years old, I don't know. They told me stories. And he would drink shots and beers. Well, I didn't like the shots, but I liked the beer. And he'd turn around, and I'd guzzle down the beer. And I'd get a little high, and I'd get up, and I'd dance. And when I danced, the men would give me pennies. Now, remember that. Remember that, because that plays another part in my story a little later on. And of course, I fell in love with that life. I really enjoyed it. What I didn't like is when we got home and my mother was enraged and she would scream and she would beat him up and there was all this chaos and crazy thing going on. Anyway, on the weekends, my father had 13 brothers and sisters. This is a family disease, and 11 of them had the disease of alcoholism. I did not know, again, what alcoholism was till I walked into my first AA meeting 30-some years later. On the weekends, my aunts and uncles would come to visit, and they would bring this fifth of four roses, a fifth between all of these people. Incomprehensible to me. And they must have had other stuff that I didn't notice, truly, because they would all get drunk, and they would go into blackouts, and they would start calling each other SOBs and GD this and all of this stuff. And I was a kid, and I didn't understand it. And I would get all anxious and all nervous, and I would go to my room because I was so fearful they were going to start hitting each other and swinging at each other. And then it would all end, and they would go home. And guess what? I was like this. They had forgotten about it because they were in a blackout, and the next week the same thing happened all over again. That's how I was raised. That was what I perceived as normal. When I was 16 years old, I had my very first drink that was my own. It was a highball in a glass about this big. I was at a teenage party. I was on a date with a young man that I really wanted to impress. I really liked this young man. I had a beautiful white dress on and lime green shoes. The party was held in a place called the Pigeon Coop. And there was a set of winding stairs that went up to the bathroom. So we went into the party, and he gave me this highball. And I drank the highball and had an instant blackout. I believe I was instantly an alcoholic, but that's another thing. I blacked out immediately. I don't have any recollection at all of what happened that evening. But as Dave was sharing earlier, I think somebody threw up all over me, too. What happened that when my friends filled me in was that I had to go to the bathroom, and there was a flood. The toilet had flooded, and the water was coming down these steps. Didn't stop me. Went up the steps, went to the bathroom, started to come down, and either I fell because I was drunk or my heel caught in my dress. Either way, it was because I was drunk, and I fell all the way down the steps. And my knees were bloody and muddy, and I was a mess. And apparently this young man, who I really did impress, took me out and put me in the car to take me home, and I vomited all over his car, him, and myself. And when I woke up, I was at home, and I was in my own home, my own bed, and I looked down, and I was a mess, and I still had on this pretty white dress, which had mud and blood and puke on it. And I can mention this. It's a very important part of my story, because I remember feeling that disgust at myself. You know, what is the matter with you? Why did you do this? You ruined this date. You did this. And I vowed I was never going to do it again. And we all know where that went. However, what I did do at that point is I think I realized a few things. And one was that I didn't need to guzzle my alcohol. So that's what I learned from that experience. Okay, go slow. Not don't drink it. No. Go slow. So I proceeded upon my career of alcoholism. And, you know, I was the caretaker of my family. My father was always losing jobs. And we were always being evicted, and we were always moving. And I moved 14 times when I was in elementary school in the middle of the night. The van would come, and everything would go. And, you know, and it doesn't make for very much security when you're a kid and you're moving in the middle of the night all the time. But I do remember thinking to myself one night when I was sitting on the front porch waiting for another date, and my father was escorted home by a policeman. He had fallen, and he was bleeding, and the police car pulled up right in front of my date's car, and I ran in the house very embarrassed and very humiliated and very ashamed, and I ran upstairs and I cried on my bed. I was probably 17 years old, and I remember promising myself I was never going to allow alcohol to do this to my children or to anybody in my life. And I really meant that when I said it, and I know that alcoholics understand that. I wasn't capable or didn't have the power to fulfill that wish, but I did not want to hurt. And again, not knowing what alcoholism was, not knowing that it was a progressive disease, not knowing that I had it, I just proceeded to try to drink like a lady. That was my goal. When I was 20 years old, I had a job with Bell Telephone Company. And I was a service representative during the day, and someone offered me this job. It's kind of like a little moonlighting job in Philadelphia as a go-go dancer at night. And I thought it was a good idea because I liked to dance, number one, and number two was all the free booze you could drink. And so I took that job, and I will clarify this. That was a lot of years ago. I kept all my clothes on. I danced in a cage, and I wasn't a hooker. So I just want to clarify. I have shared that story before, and those are all the questions that I got afterwards, so I thought I'd just straighten it out now. Not to say that could not have happened to me, it just didn't. Anyway, I really enjoyed that job. It was one of the best jobs that I ever had. And I did it for a whole summer until my supervisor at Bell Telephone found out about it. And in those days, you didn't have the same rights that you have today. And she came to me and she told me it was either I quit the go-go dancing job, or I was going to be fired as a service representative. And I'll tell you the truth, I didn't want to quit that go-go dancing job. I really liked. That gave me freedom. But I had to take care of my family, and I had to pay the bills because my father was unable to do so. And I was one of those super responsible children of alcoholics, and so I kept the job at the telephone company. And I began to see then that maybe alcohol was playing a little tiny part in my life's choices and things that were happening. I was very resentful at that supervisor, by the way. I blamed her for everything that ever happened to me ever again at the telephone company. No resentment. And then, at 22 years old, I got married. And I married a man who was not an alcoholic. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever experienced being in a relationship with someone who is not an alcoholic. It is not an easy thing to do. I learned very, very early in that marriage to become a liar, a cheat, and a sneak when it came to my drinking. It fascinates me when I look back. It never dawned on me not to drink or to look at the fact that maybe alcohol was the problem. I never looked at that. I always blamed everybody else. I always put the blame on him. And so he was, in my opinion, probably someone who might handle the label workaholic. I don't want to label him, but he worked all the time and was gone all the time. And so that gave me more freedom to drink. And the next thing that I decided was that I drank because I wanted to become a mother and I was unable to get pregnant. So the next thing that I did was adopt a child. We adopted a child, a little baby, a little girl, biracial. She was 7 weeks old when we got her back in 1972. And I thought this was going to fulfill me. And again, didn't know I had the disease of alcoholism and it was progressing. I thought that if I could fill this empty hole inside of me by becoming a mother, that everything was going to be wonderful, and we all know how that goes. That did not work. In the meantime, my husband was transferred to Peach Bottom, and we moved to Maryland. So what happened to me then was that I lost all of my enablers that were back in the Philadelphia area. I did not drive, which was a blessing. I didn't think it was at the time, but in retrospect, I realized that God was sparing me all those years that I didn't drive. And we moved to Maryland, and I started to connect with the people in the neighborhood that drank. We were in a boating community, and that was real easy to do. And for many years, I kind of enjoyed myself, starting to raise my daughter. I was pregnant. I became pregnant, finally. I was just so thrilled. I was so thankful to God that he enabled me to become pregnant, and then I had a little boy. And that was in 1975. And so here I was with this beautiful home on the water in Joppa Town. Marriage was never good, so I can't say that. But having the children that I wanted and trying to fulfill this role that I genuinely wanted to fulfill as a mother, as a good mother. And I couldn't understand what was happening to me. By this time, I had realized at some level that I was not capable of drinking in public. I had made a fool of myself so many times and embarrassed and ashamed myself so many times that I realized that I better just drink at home alone. Again, never dawned on me not to drink. So I became pretty much an at-home drinker. My day would start out, and I was a homemaker. I stayed at home and took care of my children and made my house look really nice. Everything was perfect. Because if my children looked well-fed and were well-dressed and my house was perfect, then nobody was going to look at the fact that I was drinking myself silly at night. See, that's what I did to compensate. And we played a game, the alcoholic game, the couples, the married game, whatever you want to call it. And the game was that we had a club room in our basement. And in that club room, we had all kinds of alcohol. And my husband would go down and mark the label with a pencil line where the alcohol level was. Didn't stop me. At that point, I became a funnel drinker. You take it out, put the funnel in, filled it back up. We played all these crazy games. And it was really interesting, too, because he knew that I knew and I knew that he knew, but we never talked about it. It was like, never, ever, ever, ever talk about it. And things were getting worse and worse and worse. And this part I'm not real proud of. I did a lot of things I'm not real proud of from this disease, but I became a thief. And I rationalized that it was okay for me to steal money from his wallet while he was sleeping because I rationalized to myself that he was cheap and he wouldn't give me any money. Well, the man wasn't going to give me money because he knew I was going to go buy a bottle. So it was that same old thing. Anyway, I do remember at night he'd go to bed early because he got up early, and I would start. By the way, I ended up drinking vodka. I didn't like vodka, but I ended up drinking vodka because you could mix vodka with anything, and I believed that you couldn't smell vodka, which, of course, we all know is not true. And when you drink a half gallon of vodka, nobody has to smell it anyway. I started drinking something called Popov vodka. Scotch was my drink of choice in beer. I like scotch and beer, but I couldn't get away with that. I didn't have any money, you know. It was getting unmanageable here. But he would go to bed, and I would go upstairs, and he'd have his wallet like this with a comb on it and the handkerchief a certain way, and I knew the whole deal. I would take them off, all the layers, open the wallet, take a $20 bill out, close the wallet, put the layers of stuff back on, and go back downstairs and have a few more drinks, and then feel guilty. Go back up the steps, go through the whole thing, put the $20 bill back. And truly there were nights when I honestly came out of a blackout with that $20 bill in my hand and the wallet, and not, I didn't know if I was coming or going. I truly did. That is the truth. That is really the truth. I didn't know if I was putting it back or taking it out. And he never said anything. So we ended up with all the bottles under the bar, water. I have one brother. He's a Catholic priest. He's a wonderful man. And when we were growing up, we were close. And then he went to become a priest. And in my sick alcoholic thinking, I got very resentful at him. And in my mind, I decided that he abandoned me. I couldn't have told you those words then. But I was angry at him because I was left with all this chaos in the house. And he was off in Blackwood, New Jersey, becoming a priest. But again, I couldn't verbalize that. But that's what was going on inside. And one Christmas, actually it was Christmas 1978, and my brother came to my home for Christmas, and I got drunk in the afternoon, which I rarely did. I didn't get drunk in front of people anymore. Well, occasionally, but most of the time. Not every day. But he, the next day I got very sick, and I thought I had the flu, and he sat down and he started talking to me about my drinking. He said, "I'm very worried about you." And he was also concerned that I wasn't raising my children in the Catholic Church. And, of course, my attitude was that I never not believed in God. But I pulled away from that because I thought I was bad. You know, I thought I was a bad person and God was going to get me because of all the stuff that I was doing. And so I just kind of pushed it aside and didn't think about it. And he had to talk with me that day. And he said, "I love you and I'm very concerned about your drinking." And, of course, I went into, it's John, that was my husband, it's John's fault, he's never home, and, you know, all this violin stuff. He didn't buy any of it. He just kept saying, "I would like to see you go back to church, and I'd like to see you do something about your drinking." And that was really the beginning of the end for me. But right prior to that, I had one final farewell fling. And I mention that because it gives you some idea of where my self-esteem was. It was Halloween, and my girlfriend, who's a pothead, called me up and said, "Do you want to go up to this place?" It was a nightclub called the Golden 40. And I really hadn't gone to a nightclub in many years. And my husband was working, of course, so I got a babysitter. And I had to come up with a Halloween costume. So I dressed myself up as a bag of trash. I wore black tights and a green plastic trash bag where I put holes through. And I wore a trash can lid on my head with trash hanging from it. She got dressed in her husband's army uniform, so she looked at least a little normal. And we walked into this nightclub. It was a Tuesday night. The Halloween party had been the Saturday night before. But it didn't stop us. I was drinking vodka and apple cider before I left my home to go to this shindig. And when I got to the bar, she was driving, thank God. She was high on pot, and I was loaded with vodka. When we got to the bar and we saw that it wasn't the party, it didn't matter. And again, what happened to me is very similar to what had happened to me many, many, many years before. I had come full circle. I went into a blackout. I don't recall anything. I woke up again at home in my bed, muddy and bloody. Thinking I was muddy and bloody. It wasn't blood, it was ketchup, because I fell off a table when I was dancing. But I had to call somebody to find out, just like I did when I was 16. Okay? And that was so horrible to me. You know, again, it's funny when I tell it now, and I too see the humor in it because I'm getting well. But when it was happening, it was horrible. It was a nightmare. It was just a nightmare. You know, the first thing I did was run to see if my children were okay. And, you know, what the hell is the matter with you, Peggy? You're such an awful person, is what I would say to myself. I just didn't know. So that was Halloween, and then that Christmas, my brother mentioned my drinking. And so in early January of 1979, I got up one Sunday morning, and I went to Holy Spirit Church, which is a few blocks from where I live. I don't really know what I was going to do. I went for the service, for the Mass. I hadn't been to church in a lot of years. It was very different than what I had remembered. They weren't doing it in Latin anymore, for one thing. And I walked into that church, and I stood in the back, and I wasn't able to focus or tune in on what the priest was saying. But I remember this so clearly because this is really where the miracle happened. This is where the gift came. I remembered as a child that I was taught that if you lit a candle and you said a prayer, that God would listen to you. And so when the Mass was ended, I walked to the votive candles in the back of the church, and I lit a candle. And that was the very first gut-level, honest, non-jackpot prayer that I ever prayed. Because always it was the jackpot. God, get me out of this one, get me out of that one. I'll do this, I'll do that, the bargaining. But this was different. Basically what I said very sincerely from the bottom of my heart was, God, help me with this drinking. Help me. And again, there weren't any whistles blowing, but something was different. And I felt it. And that was on a Sunday. And I went home and I drank Sunday night and I didn't get drunk. By the way, I had reached a point where I was drinking and blacking out and or passing out every single night when everybody was in bed. Get on the CB radio and call people up and do all kinds of things. I used to get severe gastritis attacks, and so in the wisdom of we alcoholics who are going to do wonderful things in the world, I used to mix vodka and Maalox. And then I was going to patent it and call it Votlox and sell it. Made sense to me. Some of you might have bought it, too. It was very disgusting combination. But anyway, I would do this every night, you know. I would drink, blackout, pass out, go to bed. I hated myself. But that Sunday night, Monday night, and Tuesday night, I drank a few drinks. But I didn't continue to drink until I blacked out or passed out. So something was different. Wednesday morning, I got up, I walked into my kitchen, I picked up the telephone directory, I called the number for Alcoholics Anonymous. The lady answered, and I told her the truth, and I asked for help. Now, I believe to this day that when I said, God, help me, that he basically grabbed me by the back of the neck and just threw me into recovery. And I didn't know what this was about. I didn't understand what AA was about. I just didn't know anything. I was very ignorant. I mean, I was impacted by the disease of alcoholism from the moment I was conceived, and yet I was 34 years old and didn't know a thing about what alcoholism was, even though it was in every area of my life. That woman was wonderful. Her name was Eileen. I'll never forget her. She told me there was a meeting that very night in the same church that I had gone to pray in. And my very first thought was, I can't go there. People are going to know me. I've never been in the church before. And she said to me, you know, Peggy, if you see, this is in the days before the court slips. She said, if you see people there that know you, they're there for the same reason you're there. And it made sense. It just made sense to me. So I bought it, and I went to my first AA meeting. And I got to tell you, I walked into that meeting that night feeling like a broken down piece of crap. That's not what I walked out feeling like. I had an absolutely awesome experience that night. And it's simple. It's no big deal to a lot of people, but to me it was. And what I experienced was hope. I experienced that maybe, just maybe, I could get what some of these people had. There was a gentleman there that shared his story that night. His name was David S. He's since gone to that big meeting in the sky. And he told his story, and his story was very different from mine, but you know what? The feelings were the same. And I was blessed with the gift of being able to listen and make the connection and connect with his feelings. I met my first sponsor's husband there that night, who came up to me after the meeting, Phil McKay. And he came up and started talking to me after the meeting, and he said that he lived on the same street I lived on, and that his wife was also a recovering alcoholic. And that she was chairing a meeting that night and gave me the address and said, why don't you stop down sometime? And the next morning, Barbara's here now, the next morning I was on her doorstep, knocking on the door, because I wanted so desperately, desperately. I saw the shiny eyes that night, and I knew from that moment I did not want to feel this pain anymore. It was horrible. And Barbara welcomed me, made me a cup of mud. We were talking about that this morning. I said, you know, I gave up alcohol. We used to go to her house and get this thick coffee, and I'd come out of there like this. What was different? But Phil and Barbara led the way for me into my recovery, and they were there for me all the time. Holidays, they'd invite me down because my husband was always gone. And so I joined that group. It was the Joppa 12-step group. That was my home group for my first 10 years of sobriety. And that was really a blessing for me also, because it was a step meeting. And so each week I would come in. Oh, by the way, the first meeting I attended was an 8th step meeting. Imagine that, not knowing a thing, coming in on the 8th step and connecting. I had nothing to do with that. It was a gift, believe me. But I kept coming back, and I began to get a little teeny-weeny tiny bit of self-esteem. When I had 1 week without a drink, because I was a daily drinker, I remember saying, a whole week, wow, I did this. Because I'm a typical alcoholic. Anything I ever started, I never finished. But I kept coming back, and I started getting connected with the winners. And Phil and Barbara started taking me to meetings, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful experience for me. And before I knew it, I was celebrating 1 year without a drink. And my first anniversary was probably the highest I've ever been in my life without a chemical, because it was so wonderful, the connectedness, the friendships, the connection with a God of my understanding, not the God that I thought was around. I mean, I had made up my mind. I'm not going to stand here and tell you that the nuns taught me God was bad. I can tell you that I believe this is a disease of perceptions. I perceived that God was going to get me. I don't know where that came from, but I have a God in my life today that gave me the gift of recovery. In addition to that, has enabled me through thick and thin to be able to continue to grow. I have many, many, many growth experiences presented to me in my recovery. I was sober a little over a year when my mom took sick. And I never liked my mother, and I never connected with my mother. And I had tremendous feelings of guilt, and I was just torn about this, because I was the daughter, and I was supposed to be there, and I was supposed to have these feelings for my mother, and why didn't I? And my sponsor helped me immensely through that experience. You know what she said to me? She had the same feelings with her mother, the same experiences with her mother. I didn't think anybody in the world ever felt that way about their mother. And here, my sponsor, there was no mistake that we were put together. She was able to share that with me and tell me that it was okay and it didn't make me a bad person. That was absolutely awesome. My mother passed, and that was the beginning of what I really understood about the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because my mother passed up in Philadelphia. I was in AA in Harford County, and I turned around in that funeral home, and there were probably, I don't know, 9, 10 people from Harford County AA. I was so touched. You know, it gives me goosebumps even now when I think about it. Because I understood then that I was never going to walk alone again. I knew it, that first year of recovery, but I didn't fully internalize it until that night when my need was great and the people were there. I will never forget that. And that was the beginning of many, many, many times in my recovery that I have been surrounded by the most wonderful people. After my mother died, about a year later, my daughter, my adopted daughter, when she was, I guess she was about 12, began her own addiction. And we didn't understand what was happening. I kind of sensed that it was probably addiction, but we kept she kept getting into these mental hospitals, psychiatric facilities, for different reasons, and she was diagnosed with just about everything you can think of, every mental illness there was, and it was getting worse and worse and worse. Matter of fact, she was in Shepherd Pratt in the locked unit, and I went to take her out for a visit one afternoon. She came out with an orange mohawk in a locked unit. I was wondering if they had turned the door around the wrong way. And again, that was the beginning of a horrible nightmare, a horrible nightmare. My daughter continued to get sicker and sicker and sicker. And I continued to try to rescue and rescue and rescue to no avail. And I finally had to detach, and I had to let go and let God. And that was one of the most painful things I ever had to do. My daughter ended up prostituting herself on the streets of Baltimore. And she was also bulimic. When she was 24 years old, I was in therapy because I was in the process of talking about ending my marriage. And I cried to the therapist one day because I said, I saw my daughter, and she looks like walking death, and I feel so powerless, so helpless, I can't do anything. And the therapist gave me wonderful advice, and what she said was, write a letter to your daughter and just tell her one more time that you love her and that if she wants help, you'll try to help her. And if nothing else comes from that, if she dies, you will know that you tried. You will know that you did the last, final effort. I wrote that letter, and I would have bet you a month's salary my daughter would not have responded. But guess what? 3 days later, my daughter called me, and she was crying. She said, Mom, I really do need help. It was the very first time that she ever admitted that she was bulimic. I had known that for 12 years, but I was powerless to do anything. She was also drinking alcohol around the clock, and she was physically in very, very bad condition. I had some people that were offering to help me, but they said that we had to get her medically stable before they would take her into treatment in Florida. And I was offered a scholarship or free treatment in a hospital up in Wisconsin. And it was a Good Friday afternoon, and my daughter and I got on the plane. It was a very trying experience because she and her boyfriend came to the airport drunk. She was smashed out of her mind. We're running down trying to get on the plane, and the security stopped us. She had a big bottle of malt liquor in one pocket, and Mad Dog, I think, was the other thing, and the other inside her pocket. And anyway, we got on the plane, and I recognized at one point that she was going to begin to go into withdrawal, and so this is interesting. After all these years I was in recovery, I had to order a drink. She was too young to get a drink. I knew she needed it. And so I ordered her a rum and Coke, and then I ordered a Diet Coke. And then, you know, I gave her the rum and Coke, and she drank it. And we got her to the facility, and that was the important thing. And I mention this, too, because this, again, was another interesting thing that happened, a very powerful experience that happened that night. And it says a lot, speaks a lot for the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. I stayed at the hospital with her as long as they would let me, and it was about 12:15 when the doctor came out, and he told me, he said, I don't think your daughter's going to make it. He said, her body is shutting. She was 24. He said, her body is shutting down. She has done so much damage between the alcoholism and the bulimia. He said, I just don't think she's going to make it. And he said, you know, I had gotten a hotel at some fancy golf place. I got it out of the phone book. And it was like 5 minutes from the hospital. He said, there's nothing you can do now. He said, why don't you just go and get some rest? We'll call you if there's any change. And I'll tell you, I had been up since like 4:00 in the morning. So I left the hospital and I went back to the hotel and I picked up the telephone and I asked the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a man answered and I said, I need a meeting desperately. It was close to midnight at this point. And there I was. I'd never been to Wisconsin before. And he said, where are you? And I told him, he said, there's a clubhouse not far from where you are with a midnight meeting. We'll be there to pick you up in 10 minutes. This is kind of funny. I went down to the lobby, and I was sitting there, and I was dressed. I don't know how I was dressed, but probably I had a skirt, at least a skirt and a blouse or something on. And I was chit-chatting with a guy in the lobby, and I looked up, and here comes this biker. With the chains and the tattoos and the bald head and all that, and I got up and I said, that's for me. And he was. He said, Peggy. And I said, Bill. And he said, yeah. And I said, come on. His girlfriend or wife was out in the van. And I'm saying this because the guy at the desk was kind of, I didn't think a thing of it. I was so happy. Hey, I'm from Harford County. So he took me to the clubhouse, and this is a beautiful part of what I'm telling you to me. Because needless to say, I was troubled. And I walked into that clubhouse, and it was a biker's clubhouse. And I sat at that meeting, and they asked me to share, and I cried, and I talked, and I shared. And you know what happened? They talk about the language of the heart. We all prayed together on our knees that night for my daughter. Me and about 15 bikers. And you know what? She got well. She made it through the night and got into treatment in Florida and put together 4 years. She has a little baby boy. I'm a grandmother. His name is Malik. He's absolutely beautiful. He's 3.5 years old. I don't think she's doing very well right now, and I just found this out a couple of weeks ago. I really don't know what the true story is, but what I do know is that I am powerless again and that I have to turn her over to God. And I have learned dealing with my children. My son's also a recovering addict alcoholic. That's another story. But what I have learned is that there's a fine line between being supportive and enabling. And I learned it the hard way, by the way. I didn't just one day wake up and have somebody tell me this, because I too am a knucklehead, like you were talking about last night. But I do know that I can't fix or change my children. All I can do is guide them, lead them, and set an example and pray for them, and that's what I do. My son, a few years back, came into a lot of money on his 21st birthday. My ex-husband had given him money that we had saved for his education, and I didn't know he had it, which doesn't matter because same thing would have happened. He spent it. He got into ecstasy, and he spent it in 6 weeks. Went to California and got himself all tattooed up, and it was a mess. But anyway, this is a little different. My son still to this day tells me he has a resentment at me for this. With my daughter, I rescued, this facility, that facility, here, there, try to fix her, try to change her, spend the money, do this, do that. When my son got in trouble, he was in a crack house down in Dundalk, and I found out where he was, and a friend of mine in the fellowship, very good friend of Marvin's and mine, Tom, and I drove down there. I walked into the house, thank you, and I saw my son. I hadn't seen him in a couple of months, and I said, Tim, I want to talk to you, and we went into this bedroom. Kids were using all over the place. And I said, I understand that you're in trouble with drugs, and I want to know if you want help. And he looked at me, and he teared up, and he said, yeah, Mom, I do. I said, well, I'll tell you what. You have 5 minutes. Get your stuff together. I'm going to take you up to Marvin's place in York. And he looked at me. He said, well, wait a minute. Maybe I can go tomorrow. I said, Tim, you have about 4 minutes now, and I'm not going to drag you out of here, and I'm not going to argue with you. But I can tell you this, if you refuse this offer, I will not be the one that's helping you again. I will always love you, but I am not going to continue to do this again. Well, he did get his stuff together, ran it all out, threw it out in the car, and we drove up, and I put him in Colonial House. And you know, my son's recovery is something that I don't think it's up to me to discuss. He doesn't do recovery the same way that I do, and that's up to him. I do believe that as of today he is clean and sober. He's tattooed and pierced from head to toe, and I love him dearly. And you know what? We laugh, and I laugh about that, but the truth is Alcoholics Anonymous taught me the meaning of unconditional love. You see, I can love a biker, and I can love somebody who's tattooed and pierced, and just because they don't look like me doesn't mean they're not like me. One of the things that I've learned in this fellowship is when I walk through that door, that we're all the same when it comes to being an alcoholic. It doesn't matter if we're old or young or black or white or rich or poor or male or female. And I'm not trying to stand here and be so super idealistic or, you know, little Mary Sunshine. I know there's differences. There's people that I don't care for. I know that. I'm not going to say everybody that walks in the rooms I fall in love with. That's not true. I'm naturally drawn to people that I have more in common with. But today what I know is just because somebody looks different doesn't mean they are. And there's the language of the heart. And that is the most valuable thing. So that's the story with my children. That was not an easy thing. I decided after 12 years of recovery, somebody told me, if you're going to leave your relationship when you come into AA and you get sober, give it as many years as you gave it when you were drinking. Okay. Drank 12 years in that marriage, sober 12 years in that marriage. I was always afraid and always worried that my husband was going to leave me. I used to sit at night and drink and have these fantasies about becoming a bag lady, and I laugh about that today. But you know what? That was very real to me because I didn't perceive that I had any skills. I didn't perceive that I had anything to offer anybody. I thought he's going to throw... I depended on this man for everything. It was a very sick relationship, and I participated. And there I was. What was I going to do? What if he got really mad at me one time because I drank too much and threw me out? You know, I just didn't think I'd ever make it. And this is the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Dave said it, and Tom said it. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to grow and change and develop as a human being. Do you know what I learned? I had an opinion, and I was entitled to have one in my marriage. I never knew that. He didn't like that, but... He didn't like my sponsor either. She taught me that. But I learned to like myself, and I started getting some self-esteem, and I did ask him to go to counseling, and I didn't want to just take 24 years and dump it, but he was unwilling to do that, and that's his stuff, you know, and that's it. So I did go into counseling, outside counseling, and I chose to leave, and I got to tell you, the expression beyond my wildest dreams. When I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, if someone had said to me, write on a piece of paper what you hope to gain, probably two or three little things would have been on there, like maybe I could learn to drink like a lady. But in retrospect, I could write volumes and volumes and volumes, because despite life on life's terms, I have been given, through Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps, the God of my understanding, my sponsor, and the people that I connect to. I have been given the tools to be able to deal with life on life's terms. A few years ago, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I had just planned a trip to go to France. And I was ready to leave to go to France when I had the mammogram and they told me I had breast cancer. And I mention this for a reason also. I went to France, by the way, and had a wonderful time. I have a God box on my desk, so I put the cancer in that. I'm not going to say I wasn't upset. I just wrote it on a piece of paper, put it in. Somebody taught me that, Joanne. Taught me that early on about the God bag or the God box. Just turn it over. And I had a most wonderful trip, and I came back, and I had the surgery that was necessary, and I had the radiation that was necessary, and I moved on with my life, and as of today, I'm fine, and I'm very, very grateful. But you know what? That whole experience that some would perceive as a tragedy, and believe me, it wasn't pleasant, but I learned something about myself through that experience that I never knew. I had a spiritual awareness. What I learned was that I came to terms with the fact that I was willing, able, and ready to accept God's will for me, and if it was to leave this earth, not that I wanted that to happen. I was at peace. I finally realized that I had peace. I spent my whole life with turmoil inside here and drinking and drinking and trying to get rid of that. But the experience of knowing that I was mortal and that there was a possibility that my task on this earth was over gave me the ability to realize that it's okay. What a wonderful, wonderful freedom that was to know that. My son came out, was diagnosed with cancer last year in his nose, and went through a lot with that. And this has been a real good month, this last month. They found a lump in his neck couple weeks ago, and we went and had a CAT scan, and you know, I just kept putting it in the God box, and I do believe it's okay. I got a letter, which I'm trying to decipher until we get to the doctor's appointment, But it looks as though it's okay and that he's going to be okay. You know, and I mention all of these things not to say to you, look at me, you know, aren't I great at... It's just like Dave was saying. I mention this because there was a time when I could break a fingernail and go on a four-day binge. Okay. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the tools to be able to deal with life on life's terms. And that to me is a miracle. And that is what I said when I said, a miracle is a shift in your perception. I had to change every way that I thought. I had to change the messages that I was giving myself. I have learned in the second surrender, they call it, that I am not only powerless over alcohol and other mood-altering substances, but I'm powerless over anything other than my own thinking. And my own thinking determines my attitude and my behavior. What a freedom that is in my life today, that I can wake up in the morning if I'm going to go to the beach and not say, oh, it's raining, I'm going to have a miserable day. I can say, it's raining, plan B, I'll go shopping. I'm going to finish with this because, again, I do believe from the bottom of my heart that God speaks through skinned faces. And there's a meeting in downtown Baltimore. It's not, no longer there, but up until a few weeks ago it was, a daily meeting called the Otterbein Meeting. And I work not far from there. And I met this woman. Her name is Lucy. Lucy's a schizophrenic fag lady. Lucy's a little bit younger than me. I'm beginning to think the whole world is here. Only kidding. But one day, I was sitting in the courtyard sharing a sandwich with Lucy, and Lucy would talk to the wind, you know, and she would just talk to the wind. And this one day, Lucy said something that just grabbed me. And what she said was, if you want to get out of the hole you're in, quit digging. And I said, there's a funny other part to the story. So I was like, wow, that's profound. It is. So I'm walking back to my office and I'm thinking, if you want to get out of the hole, you're going to quit digging. Anyway, my next client came in and he happened to be, I'm an EAP counselor, and he happened to be a doctor and a very arrogant doctor. No offense. And he's going on and on and on about this thing that's going on in his life, and the moment was right. And I didn't tell him Lucy said it. I said, someone once said, if you want to get out of the hole you're in, quit digging. And guess what? I truly believe this. Nobody can tell me any different. You could never change my mind on it. God spoke through Lucy, who spoke through me, who spoke to that doctor. It changed his life. He came back to me 2 weeks later and reported to me. He wanted to deck me that day. But when he thought about it, he realized that he was digging himself into a situation. He was getting worse and worse and worse. And that is how it works. And that has worked for me that way over the years. Always. I can get something, some wisdom from someone who's got 24-hour sobriety. I can get wisdom from somebody who's still drinking. The other thing that I have learned is that I believe that everything is a lesson. And it's going to continue to be repeated to me until I learn the lesson. Briefly, we were having a conversation last night about relationships, and I just mentioned this briefly. You know, I left that marriage. I walked into a graduate program. I hadn't been to school in 30 years. My sponsor had just completed it, and I was walking in her footsteps. I was terrified, terrified. I didn't even know how to turn a computer on. I had to type all these papers. Guess what? I did it. You know why I did it? Because of you people, because of the God of my understanding, and because of the tools of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not because of anything I did, but because everyone was there, right with me, to walk with me through it, beyond my wildest dreams. I did that as I was leaving that marriage, recognizing that I am a valuable human being. I have positive qualities, and I do have negative character defects that I know what they are, and I continue to grow, and I continue to work on them. But no more do I feel like a total piece of crap. Today I know that I am a worthwhile human being and that God has given me gifts and that I have to use those gifts to share and give to other people in order to be able to keep them. So it's not a matter of I'm wonderful. It's not a matter of that at all. It's a matter of I've been given the opportunity to have these gifts and to be able to share with other human beings. So I am absolutely thrilled. This is my very first time to do something like this, by the way. And I was a little nervous when I heard these guys speaking. But I realize now you guys are a laughing crowd, so it's good. So I want to thank you all for your attention, and I want to thank Linda for asking me to come and share my experience with you. And I'd just like to leave you all with this message. If there's anyone here that thinks it doesn't work, think again. This program's available for anyone, anytime, any place. All we have to do is show up and be willing. Thank you.